Welcome back to Film Posers for Boricuas ranting, raving, and reviewing cinema. Today, we'll be talking about period pieces, and our moderator will be Gabriela Burgos. Take it away.
Hello, everyone. It is I, the Poser's resident period piece lover. So, the textbook, you could say, definition of a period piece is, in the world of Hollywood, a period piece specifically refers to a film, TV series, or miniseries that is set during an earlier time. Period pieces often have high budgets and involve complex shoots, but the extra effort ensures that the audience is transported into a past era. A period piece may include notable people, places, or events from history, but their historical elements may or may not be important to the film's story. So as part of this episode, the Posers watched a few period pieces, and we will get into it later as to their reactions to it and all of that. But before we get into that, Josie, can you tell us the different types of period pieces?
So there are four types of period pieces. All of this information was taken from masterclass.com, so that is my source.
Oh, mine too!
Yeah, so the first type of period piece is the biopic, which, in summary, focuses on one person and their life. And that can be films such as Marie Antoinette or Rocketman. The second one is the costume drama, which usually features elaborate costumes, sets, and props in order to create a spectacle. These can be films such as Little Women, most Jane Austen novels, and The Beguiled. Then you have the historical romance. It is a period drama with a romantic relationship at the heart of the story. This includes films such as Pride and Prejudice and Titanic. And then you have the fourth type, which is historical epic. This is a costume drama with extraordinary settings, a large cast, and grand dramatic ambitions. Features large battles and tales of mythical, biblical, and or royal figures. This can be films such as Gladiator, The Mummy, and Pirates of the Caribbean.
So, Josie, is there a specific type of period piece that you prefer to others?
I think I'm usually very fond of the historical romance, mostly because my two favorite films ever have been period pieces. My first favorite film when I was younger was Titanic, and then my favorite film right now is Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
To the surprise of absolutely no one.
Absolutely. So historical romances definitely have captured me the most, but I'm pretty drawn to all four. I am a period piece connoisseur.
Yes. What about you, Juan?
My favorite is usually, when I was growing up, I loved the historical epic because I loved to watch the Pirates of the Caribbean trilogy, as Josie mentioned. I loved it. They were like 2 hours and 40 something minutes sometimes, and I was drawn to the screen. It's like one of the only times you got me to watch history and not be bored by it. But as I've grown up, I've leaned more towards biopics because one of the favorite films I saw in 2019, to the surprise of no one, is Rocket Man. I adore that movie. I love the costumes in that movie. I think it is just so well done. Like, chef's kiss.
Honestly, I revisited the other day the Honky Cat sequence. And it just reminded me of how good the film was.
It holds like, up really well.
Yes. The attention to detail and the fact that everyone was singing. I did not know that. I found that out the other day. And I'm like, every single person actually sings.
Yup. It hits differently when you find out some of the details. And when you can appreciate with the rewatches is the costume design. And you can see the details on them. For example, the baseball suit that Taron Egerton wears. I'm in awe of it.
I think one aspect that I loved about Rocket Man is how, you know, at the beginning of the film, he walks into the group therapy session and he's in his full costume. And as the film progresses, he keeps losing, like, parts of the costume until in the end he's just wearing a t-shirt and shorts. And it's kind of like how we keep uncovering each layer of Elton John as the movie progresses. It's one of my favorite aspects.
I saw it as that, but I also saw it as how he kept losing a piece of himself till he got to that moment where he had to admit it was a problem.
Yeah, he basically buried himself and was literally exposed. And
then, of course, you have Richard Madden.
Absolutely. Definitely. Wonderful. Artistic. Impactful.
Never be the same. Robbed from the Oscar.
No, honestly,
his performance was robbed. I'm not even lying. Both of them.
Rocket Man.
Yeah, definitely. Like the last thing, because we could go on about Rocket Man forever, honestly. wink wink. The podcast. Pero, so the thing with Rocket Man is that it was definitely a snub, and the more time passes, the more people talk about it. So I'm glad that it's a general consensus.
It is all thanks to Bohemian Rhapsody, but you know, we will get into that conversation another time. Anna, is there a specific type of period piece that you prefer?
First of all, I want to expose myself and say that I haven't seen Rocket Man.
Sabía que lo iba a decir. So as soon as you started, I was like, it's Rocket Man, isn't it?
So that's why I didn't contribute. I was like, should I or should I expose myself? But yes, this is me exposing myself.
The Anna expose.
Yes. I'm going to start my note ad apology.
Which, if you want to correct that mistake, it is available to watch for free with your Amazon Prime subscription on Amazon Prime Video. You might even be able to find it on Hulu.
To see it.
Yes. The agenda.
Just in case you want to correct those mistakes.
I'm with Juan on this also, because when you're small, when you're like a child, you are drawn to historical epics such as Pirates of the Caribbean. However, when you start growing up, you tend to like other stuff. So lately, I've been now more into historical drama. And yeah, especially Asian ones, I'm beginning to like watch historical drama, like Korean based TV series, and it's so interesting, and I love the costume, the story behind it. It's so interesting, and yeah, but also I like some of the biopics. Especially, I think my favorite one is The Imitation Game.
Yes.
Which I feel not many people talk about that one.
People have seemed to have forgotten about it. I love that film.
The Imitation Game is good. Also, a thing to note that's very important before we get into the rest of the episode is that a period piece can even be High School Musical at this point.
True.
Which is something they actually point out in the series when they're looking for costumes for the musical, and they're like, it's a period piece, and I'm like, oh, we're at that stage now.
Yeah,
but anything before now can be considered a period piece. Like, for example, anything in the 90s, for example, again, Selena the series, that is a period piece because you have to recreate an entirely different world at this point.
I don't like to say that because it makes me feel very old.
Yeah,
I know, but it's the reality. Like, if you're trying to rebuild the 90s, it's different advertisements, it's different hair, different kinds of clothes. So anything like even the early 2000s, that is a period piece, and it hurts.
Oh my god, Clueless is a period piece.
Honestly,
Clueless is a period piece.
Waiting for the day that John Tucker Must Die becomes a period piece.
It is a period piece.
It is a period piece.
I'm ready. Which, taking it back to the episode, Anna, you said that some films get forgotten, and I do agree with that, because recently there was a period piece that was flown under the radar called Stardust, which is a Bowie biopic, but in the defense of why it went under the radar, it contributes to what Josie said of painted in a bad light, where it wasn't taken into Bowie's perspective at all. It didn't paint him in the best light. It didn't tell a great story, and even the family spoke out against it, which I feel can make or break a biopic.
And the thing is that they weren't allowed to use Bowie's music because the film was done without his family's like approval. So the movie doesn't even have his music in it. So what's, you know, what's the point at the end?
And from what I've seen of the stills, the costumes, I can tell you, as a Bowie fan myself, I'm a fan of Bowie, I'm a fan of Queen, I can tell you that the costumes are not hitting the way that Bowie once wore them. Like, it doesn't have that je ne sais quoi that David Bowie brings to you whenever you're in his, you were in his presence.
Yeah, also a very important thing to notice is that a period piece would be like, for example, just to clarify, even though we can see these films like Eska Musical, for example, again, as a period piece, I wouldn't necessarily call the film a period piece because, again, it was made during that time. Now, if you were to recreate High School Musical now in the 2000 setting, like High School Musical, the musical, the series does, then that plays into the period piece element because you're trying to recreate a past setting. It's all about the costumes. It's all about the setting.
So with that being said, technically, movies like The Mummy are considered period pieces.
Yes, that's so that falls into historical epic.
This is explaining a bit of my childhood right now.
So where does Boogie Nights come like drop in?
What I haven't seen Boogie Nights.
I think it's a costume drama.
It would fall. It's more the disco era, from what I recall. It's a costume drama. Yeah, I'd put it towards costume drama.
Yeah. The most common ones are historical romance and costume drama. The difference is that historical romance, the important part of it is the romance, the relationship, while a costume drama, it's all about the setting and the physical appearances of the characters. It's all about the way it looks. So Nice Guys is a costume drama.
Love that.
And you know what else is a costume drama? Jack and Jill.
So in my case, I do love a good historical romance like Josie. But I love every single kind of period piece. I love watching them. In the end, it really doesn't matter. As long as it's a period piece, I will watch it. I have seen so many of them, and like TV shows, you name them, I love them all.
Yes, but you asked for a favorite.
Historical romance. I can't lie to myself. I can't be like, oh yes, I love the history. No, I need to be honest with myself. It's all about the romance, all about the yearning, the journey, the slow burn. Like one of my favorite period pieces, The Lighthouse.
Masterpiece.
Absolutely.
Criterion Collection Pack Wando.
When?
It is, in fact, a historical romance.
It's a historical romance.
And you can't change our minds.
If you're listening to this, The Lighthouse is a historical romance. We said it. It is film poser approved.
Not even joking. Watch it and then come back if you haven't seen it. We're not wrong.
Just two bros.
You can't tell me they're heterosexual bros. You can't.
So, as I mentioned before, the posers watched a few period pieces because obviously there's too many of them. And right now we're going to discuss them because some of them were first watches for the posers. The assigned films were Pride and Prejudice 2005 by Joe Wright, the superior one, obviously.
Them's fighting words.
Yes. The Favorite from 2018 by Yorgos Lanthimos. The Beguiled from 2017 by Sofia Coppola. Marie Antoinette from 2007 by Sofia Coppola. And finally, Atonement from 2007 by Joe Wright. Okay. So I personally have seen all of these films and I love them for individual reasons. But I just want to hear from the posers. I want to hear their thoughts on some of them. And I want to start with Anna, since she is the poster that has seen the least amount of period pieces. I just want to start with her.
In her defense, Paddington 2 is a period piece.
It is a masterpiece also.
Okay.
True words have never been spoken.
Anna, what was your favorite period piece?
The one that it was the most impactful for me was Atonement.
I knew it.
Because I couldn't believe what I just saw in a way with the story. I was, okay, let's go. The story. First of all, it was frustrating what I was seeing. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go into spoilers. I don't like the, I don't like Bryony. Like the character Bryony, I hate her. She's a child.
No, but... fuck that. If I see her, it's on site. I'm sorry. I don't care.
So, okay. So something happens. If you got it for the audience that doesn't know what Atonement is, something happens that two people, they fall in love, you know, Keira Knightley and James McAvoy, they fall in love. However, they can't be together because, sorry, Ronan's
because of a child.
Because of her child. They can't because of her. And it was so frustrating seeing that unfold because justice wasn't served. No. Okay. When it comes to the production design, I really like it. I thought it was really fitting with the aesthetic and the storyline. The costumes, they weren't that high end as the other ones that I saw from like the other lists, but they were okay. However, when it came down to recreating the beach scene where it takes place on the Battle of Dunkirk, mm-hmm. that was amazing.
Yeah, Christopher Nolan is shaking.
He took notes, okay? Yes. He took notes with this movie. It was really great. I loved how it was just like a 5-minute shot, notes, like one take of the whole recreation of the battle. And I thought it was great. This movie was the one that I liked, even though the ending, I was really mad. I was really frustrating. Yeah. Frustrated when I just saw.
Fun fact, I actually assigned this film because I previously had mentioned it in one of our What We Watched Recently episodes, and I just wanted the posters to suffer with me. So I assigned this film just to have someone else to suffer with me. Thank you, Anna. Welcome. Welcome to the Bryony Hate Club.
I need a therapy session after this.
No, yeah. And what did you think overall of the setting?
I thought it was pretty great. It wasn't over the top, a diferencia de Marie Antoinette, because the Marie Antoinette one was a lot, and yeah. that was astounding when I saw. But with this one, it fit the aesthetic with mm-hmm. what they were going, but it didn't wow me like the other ones did.
Yeah, because Atonement, if you were to look at the definition of it, it is focused on the romance, so it is technically a historical romance. Mm-hmm. Because you do see, you know, important historic moments, you know, like Dunkirk, as well as at the end the event that happens on the subway in London. That was actually something that happened, so we do see historical elements of it, but in the end the focus is the romance.
Yeah, it was. But the parts where they focus on the historical side, like Dunkirk, I thought it was pretty well done.
Yeah, it truly was. Is there anything else the rest of the posers wants to say about Atonement?
I mean, I wish I could finish it. I was really enjoying it, but my viewing experience got stuck in buffering purgatory. I only made it halfway through the film. But what I saw and what I was able to enjoy, I really did enjoy. It's just a good film to keep you on your toes. So if you're looking for something that has romance but also a little bit of suspense, definitely watch it. Because I really like the way they handle tone and atmosphere in this film. Because at times it kind of feels like a horror film, mostly because you're seeing it from the perspective of a child. And...
the child.
Yeah. The thing about her that was very interesting is how most of the time when you get a sense of horror during the film, it's whenever she witnesses sexuality, which usually is portrayed very differently from period piece to period piece. For example, Rocket Man, since it's the first one that comes to mind, sexuality is handled one way, especially with when Elton is confronted by his manager about how to handle that when it comes to the press. And then you have The Favorite, which we will be discussing, which deals with a love triangle between three women, which queer sexuality and period pieces to show that is just chef's kiss. Because usually sexuality itself is so put to the side, because what? Women thinking about sex in a period drama? Gasp. But I like when those topics are addressed, especially it's very interesting depending on who directs a piece. Because an example I wanted to bring to this was Emma, because you do see anatomy, you do see people naked, and you do see those kinds of moments where people are by themselves and how they think and how they ponder and how they react to another person. So it's just very interesting to see those aspects in period pieces and how it's been changing. But yeah, going back to Atonement, it's just very interesting how that is seen with such horror through the eyes of a child.
Yeah. Definitely. Yay, I'm so glad that you liked it and that Josie, that you are liking it as well.
Yes, it's really fun, especially there's a scene in the library where she catches Keira Knightley and James McAvoy doing the devil's tango. And she's just staring at them in this horror, and they're just mounted against the door and against the wall. And it just reminded me of literally a horror scene, like when someone comes across a ghost or maybe the clown from It just standing in a corner staring at you. It felt like that. It had that kind of setup, which again, it was very interesting to see sexuality through the eyes of a child and how that influences the turn of events for the rest of the film. Because, I mean, again, sexuality is so brute in this film specifically.
Anna, thank you for supporting the Atonement agenda.
You're welcome.
Now I go to Josie. Which of the films assigned your first viewing did you like the most?
So the ones I hadn't seen were Marie Antoinette, The Beguiled, and Atonement. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to join Anna, and I would probably say that Atonement was my favorite, but since I have not finished it, I will say The Beguiled.
Yay!
Even though I did notice finally, and I have accepted it, I do not mix well with Sofia Coppola's filmography. I don't know why. Hopefully if I keep watching it, maybe something. But at least I did not connect with Marie Antoinette, which is very sad. But The Beguiled, I did vibe with it.
For those of you who don't know, The Beguiled is my favorite Sofia Coppola film. I absolutely love that film, and I think, and I could, I don't think, I am insisting that it is a part of the Good for Her universe.
Yeah, I have not seen the rest of her filmography, so I cannot say, but I'm pretty sure it is probably her best, just because, I don't know, there's just something about Sofia Coppola's films that there's something missing for me, and I don't know what it is. I wish I knew, but there's something about her style that I can't vibe with, especially with Marie Antoinette. I felt so disconnected from it, but I did like how she handled the film.
Yes, I think for me, the film that actually made me fall in love with Sofia Coppola's work as a director was actually The Virgin Suicides, which I know may be controversial, but it's just the way that she handles that topic and the tone of that film is so fascinating and so well done that after I saw that film and I, you know, rewatched The Beguiled and Lost in Translation, you know, it just clicked for me. But that was just me. But I do recommend The Virgin Suicide, which could be considered a period piece since it takes place in the early 2000s, so.
Yeah, I do know that The Beguiled was good. The use of setting, scenery, atmosphere, pauses. It's, I think that was the thing for me with Marie Antoinette, because it was very slow paced, and Sofia Coppola's filmography, from what I've noticed, is very realistic. It plays a lot into realism. Mm-hmm. And I think it worked better with The Beguiled than Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, I agree. I also like how in The Beguiled, it's kind of like the first time in her filmography that there is kind of like this creepy aura also, because yes. We don't know what's going on. We don't know how this is going to unfold. So there's a lot of tension in this film. And I really love that aspect of it.
I just felt that I wish I could have loved more this film in a sense. Because, yes, I do agree with the creepy undertone. However, when it came down to the twist, I just expected something more wild or sinister. Like, something worse could have happened. Like, okay, something did happen to the character. But I thought...
You wanted them to chop him off?
Honestly, I was waiting for that.
I was waiting for something worse. However, it felt very como que... slow, like the same. Payoff was slow, and I kind of wanted more. However, now when it goes down with the production design and the costume, I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the story. It was the story for me that it just didn't work out.
Oh, 100%. I'm on the same page as Anna. I love the production design of The Beguiled. I love the costume design. The story and I did not vibe together. I could not get into it, and at times I kind of felt like it lost its way. I don't know if Anna felt the same way.
So I felt that like in the second act of the film.
Yep.
Because it was such a slow rise to the second act, and I was like, okay, but what's gonna happen next? And it's just like, oh, slowly goes to the third act, and I'm like, okay, I want more. Something else. Give me something else.
I'm like, just, you know, you could do more besides amputate his leg. You could have just, like, gone for the rest of it. You know? Just, like, go for the other leg.
Get me the anatomy book.
That was so funny.
Yes.
Also, how... I just... One scene that I absolutely lose my mind at every time I watch it is when Colin Farrell just yeets the turtle across the room.
No, that made me so sad.
I was so mad.
Gabriela, don't make me laugh. That was sad.
It's so random. He just takes the turtle and throws it.
I hate him. We all hate him.
But I'm just saying, that was just funny. He's just like, he's so... Sir, what did the turtle do to you, sir?
That turtle is going to need counseling for like the rest of his life.
I did like something that I only noticed after reading a Letterboxd review, as we tend to do on this podcast. And something they pointed out was that this is the first film where Kirsten Dunst actually has some semblance of freedom, because of Marie Antoinette. We all know how that's going to end. Mm-hmm. And The Virgin Suicides, I have not seen it, but
yeah,
there is an element of a lack of freedom. And then here, she actually is able to make a choice for herself. Even if she's not able to leave the way she wants to, she's able to get what she wants. Which was a very interesting thing to see, seeing as how everything played out to get to that point. But still, she got some semblance of happiness at some point of the film, which is more than she was able to get in the others.
Yeah, I agree. I hadn't noticed that before, and I agree. Because, you know, as some directors that they tend to work with the same people, Sofia Coppola and Kirsten Dunst have worked together so many times. And she has said that Kirsten Dunst is kind of like her inspiration as well. So they have done a lot of films together. But yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I like the film because I've noticed that Sofia Coppola definitely, again, plays into that realism. And I... concur.
Yes, I just love how the shot of the end resembles the shot of the beginning, but it's completely different, kind of like what David Fincher did in Gone Girl. I don't know, I think that ending, yeah, that final shot is actually what made me fall in love with that film. I just thought it was brilliantly done. How, yeah, it's also darker. I love it.
Because they say from the beginning, he's a dead man.
Mm-hmm. I know. There's a lot of foreshadowing that leads towards it. and then the payoff. I love it.
Okay.
So moving on, we have The Favorite by Yorgos Lanthimos.
This is actually my favorite out of the pile, but again, I'd already seen it.
Yes. So I think the only poster that hadn't seen this film previously was Juan.
I'm taking out my notes up. Apology. I would like to apologize for not seeing The Favorite when it was during its Oscar season.
Okay, so we're just going to start with you, Juan. What did you think of The Favorite?
So, as of this recording, I have mixed feelings about it. I don't know where I stand with it. Hopefully, by the time this episode is uploaded, I will have figured that out. But I both like it, and I'm also, like, bored. So here's the thing. I love the romance angle between the three. I love that. I feel everyone else is unnecessary. Because I'm here, like, I don't need to see certain people there. Although I do like the scenes where Emma Stone is, like, entertaining that one guy. And I'm here like, good for her. You go. You go. But on the other hand, while the debates are good, I feel, for example, there's a scene where they're throwing pellets at a man. And he's like naked. And I'm here like, God, I didn't need to see this, Yogoros. I'm not gonna lie. Like, it just made no sense. It didn't work for me. So I feel I'm leaning towards it, but I'm also like hesitant. I don't know. Maybe it just didn't. It hasn't sat well for me. I think the cast does a good job, a really good job. Rachel Weisz, onto that, yes, she always understands the assignment. She has never missed on the assignment, and I don't think we applaud her enough for that. I feel Gabriela will agree with me there.
Obviously. Hello. What am I? A monster?
No. No, you are not. You are kind. You are reasonable. I'm not gonna lie, though. I was keeping an eye on Olivia Colman's performance because I'm here like, okay. I was part of the people who wanted Lady Gaga to win. And only Lady Gaga to win, God, the best actors. And I'm not saying she didn't do a good job. She did a really good job. Pero, putting my awards hat on, I actually would have given it to Glenn Close.
I mean, everyone thought Glenn Close was going to win that year. So the upset Olivia Colman pulled is still one of the biggest ones in Oscar history. People still talk about that upset.
Yeah, me. I'm still upset about it.
Like, I'm not upset about it because I did love Olivia's performance.
She's really good. I'm not going to fault her there. She is really good. When she's great, she's great. However, at times, it could have been the way Liberty was reacting, because my internet sometimes, like Josie said, buffered. And I kind of like missed some dialogue. It came out choppy. But sometimes I was like, did I miss something important? Or no, but I'm going to still keep like shuffling along. So yeah, I'm torn about The Favorite so far. I hope to one day figure it out. Yeah. But my favorite film out of the assigned list, I saw The Beguiled, The Favorite, and Marie Antoinette.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think I'm going to give it to Marie Antoinette.
Perfect.
Because I love the soundtrack. When I heard a rock version of I Want Candy, I lost it. I love that Sofia Coppola was like, you know what? We're going to fix a couple of things of Marie Antoinette. First off, we're never going to have her say, let them eat cakes. And we're also going to have her in Converse, because this technically isn't a biography.
That's a Letterboxd review.
Yes.
Damn it. Okay. I thought this was me coming up with an original thought to the Letterboxd reviewer.
Oh my
God, I'm so sorry.
Oh my God.
The Letterboxd review I did see says, Marie Antoinette, I have done nothing wrong ever in my life. Me, I know this and I love you. And I'm here like, mira, when she saw Jamie Dornan at the club, I'm here like, you know what, Marie? Go risk it all for that man.
Yes.
You go, girl.
Yes.
Good for her. I mean, at the end of this film, it's not good for her because she dies, but...
Sofia Coppola, we are going to clear up that Marie Antoinette did not say, let them eat cakes, that designer. That's cool and all, but shouldn't we take these Converse shoes out of the shot? Sofia, what is this? A documentary?
She's wrong. She's not
she's so wrong.
Perfect.
She needed to leave those Converse in the shot.
Perfect. So the thing about Marie Antoinette is that a lot of people like to shit on it for not being historically accurate. And it really pisses me off.
But that's the point.
Exactly. That's the point. And second of all, like my first point actually, is that Quentin Tarantino is constantly praised for altering history in his films. So why can't Sofia Coppola do it?
That was literally my thought watching this, because I had a feeling it some of this wasn't accurate, but I didn't mind. I was like vibing along because I kind of got what Sofia was doing. It was like a modern retelling, and I'm here like, yo, this hits. I like it. And then Tarantula goes and does Inglourious Basterds, and everyone's like, outstanding, never been done before. You are so brave. And I'm here like, Marie Antoinette está ahí mismo. Dile hola.
And that's something that also happens in Dickinson, which it has been praised for, the fact that even though you're telling Emily Dickinson's story in pre-Civil War era, you still have modern day colloquialisms, like words we say right now. They say YOLO in the show. They use current cigarettes, not pipes or anything. So unless they're hipsters, which is actually a thing that happens. And it plays around with that. And it really reminded me, like when I was watching Marie Antoinette, I can definitely see the inspiration.
Yeah, Marie Antoinette definitely inspired many filmmakers, you know, to look at, you know, eras to be more extravagant, because I feel that before that, so many period pieces were contained and tried their best to be as accurate as possible. And then Sofia Coppola did Marie Antoinette. And while some things are accurate about it, the level of extravagance, I personally think it was perfect, because, you know, part of the reason that the French Revolution happened was due to the extravagant life that Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI were living. So this film showcases that perfectly. I just think this film handled that topic very well, and that the extravagance of it all, the music, the Converse, end up tying into it perfectly.
And I think the best part of this film is that it doesn't place the blame on her as history has, because though there was extravagant spending, we also have to remember that a lot of that spending went into the war effort, more so than what she was purchasing it itself. The problem was that there was a strain in the country because they were aiding the American Revolution, and that's why they had to raise taxes. And then you see this woman still spending as if they didn't have problems, because she probably was not informed of what was happening because she was a woman. And then, of course, there's that scene where she's like addressing rumors as if they were tabloids, which is really just the people complaining about what was happening. And they were probably just so disconnected. So I like this, how Sofia Coppola handled that, because usually people are very quick to blame Marie Antoinette for all the problems. But, I mean, it was the men.
Yeah.
And I mean, also,
the American Revolution not wanting to back France after they gave them help. But this is another 20.
Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things that I really like about the film is how Sofia Coppola, like Josie said, doesn't shift the blame on Marie Antoinette, but in a sense, it makes her like she is still a child. And we get to see that throughout, well, Exhibit A, the Converse, because if you see the scene specifically, it's around, you know, big shoes, like, made mostly for women. However, when they put the Converse there, it shifts to like a sense of innocence on her. And the other thing was, when it comes around with the soundtrack itself is like pop music and indie, and you mostly see it on coming of age stories and other films such like that. So that's how I kind of feel that way, that it's also she wants to portray like an innocence on Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, because we also have to remember that this is basically is her coming of age.
Yeah, and I remember in the film they showed her in the beginning when they were taking her to basically be taken away as the new bride. she was so young and all she wanted to hold on to was her dog, the cute little pug. And I'm here like, okay, cute, it's a pug, I love it. And then they took away the pug and I'm here and they're like, you can have other French dogs. And I'm here like, excuse you, give her back the pug. But as she grows up, you see that sense of what she's realizing she's supposed to do, but no one exactly tells her either throughout the film, in terms of like, oh, so here are your daily tasks. The only time they try to do that is when they're trying to basically say, you have to consummate the marriage, you have to consummate the marriage. And he's like, I'm tired, I'm shrugging it off. I've had a long day of hunting. And I'm here like, is it me or did that character? I'm here like, was he really hunting? Was he?
No.
Was he not having just a couple of drinks with the guys in a sauna?
The way I saw Louis' experience was that, again, the way Sofia Coppola portrays the king is basically does not engage in intimacy with Marie in the beginning because he just feels so inexperienced. He feels like a child, especially like when they're at the party and he's moving his cape around because they still haven't consummated the marriage. And then like you see him and then you see Jamie Dornan's character and here is a man and the other one just comes off as a child. So the point of view or the perspective that Sophia adds to his character was very interesting because I don't even think it was just him being disrespectful to her. I think he was just genuinely intimidated and didn't know what to do.
Once again, proving that men are terrible at communication. If he would have just been honest, she would have just been like, hey, I understand. Let's work something out.
Yeah,
because,
it
you
took
know,
another
future,
man yeah, to explain it to him.
Yeah, because it's like, that in that scene I thought of as like the father figure finally explaining to him what the birds and the bees are.
Yeah, because his father was actually preoccupied with someone else, so he didn't have time for his own son.
I love this discussion. I didn't expect Marie Antoinette to go that deep, but I love this.
Yeah, yes. There's a lot to unpack here.
Yes, I love it. So now let's go back to the favorite. So Juan already expressed his thoughts, and well, Josie, Anna, and I had previously seen the film, and yeah, Anna.
It's a fun film.
Yeah, just talk about it. It's fun. I love the dialogue in it.
I love the deadpan humor.
It's so good.
It's so good.
The dialogue is so clever, and it's one of the best parts of the film. Like, the screenplay itself is so delicious. It's such good writing.
Can you believe that Green Book won over this screenplay?
It's a crime.
Yes, the screenplay is excellent. And I love how it is a six-act film and it works very well. Because it could have easily been very messy, but it works.
It does. And I think this is the most engaging Yorgos Lanthimos film. From his filmography, that's what I think.
And it's the less fucked up, also.
I can't add to that because I haven't seen his entire filmography, but I will say it is, in fact, a very engaging film.
But I also cannot add to that filmography thing, but thank you for making sure that I do not add to that. I don't think I'm mentally prepared for that.
Like, it's fucked up, but it's the least fucked up.
I mean, yeah, when you see The Lobster and when you see Killing of a Sacred Deer, The Favorite is a family movie.
Oh my gosh.
It will be shown on airplanes. Children will be able to watch it and talk about it for centuries.
I did. I actually rewatched this film on an airplane once.
My point.
It's a fun film.
It is.
And also, so much fun. Again, I love how it handles sexuality. It doesn't gloss over it and it takes you at an even pace, but once you get, like, once you find out that it is in fact gay, it's wonderful.
Yes. I had the most dramatic reaction when I watched this film in theaters. I had no idea because I hadn't seen trailers or anything. I just went to the theater with my friend to watch it. And when it was revealed that it was in fact gay, I had such a reaction, and my friend was just laughing because she knew and she thought I knew. So it was just a whole thing, and I love this film. It is my favorite one of his, followed closely by Killing of a Sacred Deer. I don't care how fucked up it is. It's a good film.
Same. It is my favorite from his filmography.
So the favorite is film poster approved.
And now we'd like to take a moment to talk to you about our sponsor, Anchor, the easiest way to make a podcast.
So the final film that we have to talk about is the one, the only, The Blueprint, Pride and Prejudice from 2005, directed by Joe Wright. Now, this is one of my all-time favorite films. And I know that there is a poster here that loves this film as much as I do, if not more. Josie, take the floor.
What? Me? I was about to tell myself and say I love Emma Moore.
Okay. Fine.
I do like Pride and Prejudice. Mostly because something I noticed watching all these films is that period pieces have a thing with hands. And you yes. know, and you know what film has a thing with hands?
Pride and Prejudice.
No, everyone's gonna hate me for it. I'm gonna give you guys 3 seconds.
Portrait.
The Last Jedi.
Oh my god! No.
Thing with hands. Rian Johnson. No, I'm just saying. Rian Johnson. I know in his free time he watches period pieces. Because he has a thing with hands in that film. And I'm like, you, sir, are a connoisseur of the arts. Because there was a thing with hands in Atonement. There yes. were shots with hands in Portrait. There were shots with hands in Pride and Prejudice. Of course, the hand flex. So I'm like, Rian Johnson, I'm on to you. You watch period pieces on your free time. I know it.
Yeah.
But other than that, we love Pride and Prejudice. I remember the first time I watched it, it was on Valentine's Day. And beautiful. Yeah, I was like, why not? And mostly it was not my decision. I was with a friend and she was like, you're watching Pride and Prejudice, because she couldn't believe I had never seen it, even though she has like 5 million different copies of the book. So of course, I was made to watch it and I enjoyed it. I will not say I was forced against my will. Though at the beginning, I was unsure, but I did enjoy myself. It was a lovely film, especially because I'm just a fan of everything that's come out of this, especially like the Lizzie Bennet Diaries on YouTube, which I resurrected and unlocked a lot of memories the other day on Twitter. But it's just a foolproof story that a lot of people like for a reason.
So I think that everyone will agree when I say that there is no better match made in heaven than Joe Wright and Keira Knightley when it comes to period pieces. Because every single one they've done together slaps. Pride and Prejudice, iconic. Atonement, iconic. Anna Karenina, we as a society need to stop pretending that it's a bad movie. It is not. I'm just saying, Joe Wright and period pieces, it's absolutely perfect. And Keira Knightley, I never want to see her do a movie in the present day. Let her wear the corsets and the long dramatic dresses. That's what she does best. Pride and Prejudice. I love this film so much. And actually, the first time I watched it, I actually didn't like it. I watched it with my friend, and I just didn't understand. I get, why do you love this film so much? I don't understand.
It's all about the yearning.
And yeah. And then I rewatched it again, and oh, it just changed things for me.
Yeah. That happened to me with Emma, here's the thing with Jane Austen adaptations. They try to be loyal to the story because, of course, it is a beloved story for a reason. There is so much to take from it. But you need to be fully present. You need to experience this film with absolutely no distractions, because the thing with Jane Austen period pieces is that you need to be in the moment. There is a lot to unpack, there is a lot to process, and there is a lot that goes on in a mere less than 5 minutes. Usually, like my experience with Emma specifically, was, because I wish I could have revisited Pride and Prejudice for this episode. Instead, I watched a 26-minute clip on YouTube of all of a compilation of all the moments between Darcy and Lizzie Bennet. So that was my rewatch in a nutshell. But I digress. My thing with Emma specifically was that I did not like it the first time, but after a couple of rewatches, I learned to appreciate it a lot because there is a lot to unpack. There is a lot of beauty to it. And with Pride and Prejudice, I think the best part is, in fact, the romance. Once you understand the complexities of what's happening, because it is a web. Pride and Prejudice is a web. There is a lot of things going on, and it's more than just the romance at the center. There are a lot of characters that connect with each other. Hay mucho bochinche, hay mucho chisme, hay mucha cosa pasando in the background. And you just really have to, like, you have to, at a certain point, if you want to do some extra credit and you haven't seen the film for the first time yet, sit down with a notebook and start writing down, like, okay, George Wickham, sus.
Facts. He's always sus. There's a lot to unpack. Like, Pride and Prejudice is not simply about, you know, the romance between Darcy and Elizabeth. Even though that's the thing that everyone talks about, there's so much more to it. You know, it brings comfort. I remember when it was on Netflix, I did a therapeutic rewatch of that film, and I recommend it. It was like a therapy session, you know, free therapy. Just rewatch Pride and Prejudice 2005. It just really gets to you.
Jackie, like, someone should make a TV show that's like a telenovela-esque Pride and Prejudice retelling. Like, Pride and Prejudice meets Jane the Virgin, and it's like a TV show.
I remember there was a Hallmark movie that was a Pride and Prejudice retelling, but it was in a dog show.
Oh, no.
It was hilarious.
I mean, it's a foolproof thing, like,
yeah.
It has that enemies to lovers pizzazz.
Yes. But also
hate each other, and then yes, they burn for each other.
God. I just, that scene where Darcy goes to find her in the gazebo and he's, you know, wet from the rain and he's like, "I love you most ardently," fucking gets me every time.
No, you know what I noticed this time around during my 26-minute compilation video?
I love that.
That she tells him to call her Divine Goddess or something along those lines. And I just stared at my screen like, I did not remember this from the film.
Yeah, because actually, fun fact, that scene, because the thing about Jane Austen is that the characters in her books never kiss. So, and they have tried to keep it that way in the film adaptations, but as time has gone on, you know, they have decided to, you know, spice them up a little bit, like Josie mentioned with Emma. So when Pride and Prejudice came out, there is a scene where we see Darcy and Elizabeth, you know, married in Pemberley, and they kiss. And that pissed off a lot of people, especially British ones.
Yeah, them off. And just hardcore Jane Austen fans, because yeah. I remember people were mad that Emma shows her butt in mm-hmm. one scene because she's just standing by a fire and she wants to get her tush warm, and people were like, no, outrageous.
Yeah.
Which I get, because if you're so used to the source material, it feels like a sin almost to change the story. But I don't know, the more you watch it, I really like how Anya Taylor-Joy handled that. And then when it comes to Pride and Prejudice, I really liked how Keira Knightley,
Matthew McFadden
handled
yeah
the chemistry and the relationship, because at again, freaking Rian Johnson, I know you watch period pieces. Because it's just using it as an example, because I think it's a perfect example, just to finish my rant on Pride and Prejudice, like when Kylo and Rey, the hand thing, the mm-hmm. fact that you can show so much intimacy, and no, it doesn't have to be a relationship thing, it can be just simply a thing of trust. The fact that you can show so much with just hands, not having to show anything else, is what I think is done so brilliantly in some of these period pieces, because you can do so much with so little.
Yeah, but I personally don't mind when, you know, more modern Jane Austen adaptations have decided to, you know, spice things up. I don't mind. And because they still keep the charm of Jane Austen, you know, it's not like having people kiss or show their butts ruins the story, because it doesn't.
Nah, it's perfect, especially in Emma when they finally
exactly.
Like, yes, hallelujah, we've been yearning for 2 hours straight.
Yes.
And hopefully with Persuasion we do get some razzle dazzle, which now we have two adaptations, so we'll see what happens. I think one will probably try to be more modern than the other. We shall see. I know that one of them is being adapted by the same people that did Jane Eyre, so again, we shall see. Hopefully we can enjoy them.
But also, you know, the most recent adaptation has been Sanditon, which I wish I could be happier to talk about Sanditon.
Okay, mama.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. Okay, so Sanditon, for those of you who don't know, it is an adaptation of Jane Austen's last book before she died, but it was incomplete. So basically, the TV show, it is 6 episodes long. It is on PBS Masterpiece. And so those 6 episodes pretty much cover what Jane Austen had written. And it, and I think by episode 4, like, it's already done. And the, and so the writers have kept going, you know, making it up and try to resemble her voice. And I personally think that they succeeded. You know, it has the weeniness, it has the yearning, it has everything. But it, they also spiced it up. And I was so excited for, you know, the possibilities for the next season. But it was canceled after the first season. And it leaves off on a heartbreaking cliffhanger. But you know what? The power of the internet. Because the fans complained for 18 months. And PBS announced that it is not only renewed for a second season, but for a third. So here I was, ready for the yearning, ready for the payoff for the romance between Charlotte and Sydney, only for Theo James to say that he's not returning for season 2. So why bother? You know, why bother anymore? You know? So the thing about Sanditon is that it's called Sanditon because it is an estate near a beach. So it's kind of like when people were discovering that, hey, you can actually go into a beach and swim in it. So there is a lot of nudity because people go into the beach in the nude, like Theo James's character. Anyways, I don't want to get into it because I'm just going to get sad and mad all over again that he's not returning for season 2. But I do think that it works with Sanditon. Again, for me, that ending in Pride and Prejudice where Darcy and Lizzie share a kiss, I love that ending. It's perfect because, you know, it shows them, you know, already happy to be together and, you know, in the newlywed bliss, and how she says, oh, you can only call me Mrs. Darcy when you're like extremely and overly happy. And he says, and how do you feel today, Mrs. Darcy? And it's like, goddamn, you smooth bastard. Pride and Prejudice really evokes a lot of feelings in me. Most of Jane Austen adaptations too. I think the one film that adaptation of her work that I'm not the biggest fan of is actually Sense and Sensibility, which stars Kate Winslet and Emma Thompson. I'm not the biggest fan of that one. I didn't click with the story as much as I've clicked, you know, with Pride and Prejudice, Emma, Sanditon, and all of those.
I just want to say I haven't finished my assignment, so I haven't seen Pride and Prejudice.
But we will make you watch it in the future. We will sit you down.
And I'm pretty much obligated. I'm pretty much being obligated to watch this movie.
Had a couple of things. One, Josie, way to get your hands on that example of Star Wars. Gabriela, are you trying to say that when Joe Wright does period pieces, he can do no wrong? Y'all kept going. You know how long I've been sitting on these jokes?
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And according to you, so is Joe. As for Pride and Prejudice, I actually first saw this film for an English class in high school. because yes, I read the book, but I was like, you know what? I have time. Let's watch the movie. My mom owns the DVD. And it was, in fact, the Keira Knightley version. And I liked it. Do I remember a lot of the stuff that happened in it? No, but I still liked it. I think Anna might like it. She might.
It's about the yearning and the hand touching.
It's all about the hand touching. Like, for example, another example, just to get The Last Jedi out of your palate. This is the palate cleanser. In Portrait of a Lady on Fire, when you notice that her hands are covered in paint and she has to hide them because that shows who she really is. So again, period pieces and hands, they go together.
As Drag Race Queen Tatiana once said, see me with them hands. I, of course, am great at citing. So yes, Pride and Prejudice, definitely recommend. It is not on streaming services right now, apparently. So if you own your DVD copy, you hold on to that. Because I don't know when they're putting it on streaming services.
God, when it left Netflix, I was so sad. I was like, how dare Netflix take away one of my emotional support movies?
And if you rely on Netflix and you have a DVD player, see if you can buy the film on DVD in case it takes a while to come back and you need it, like Gabriela, like an emotional support.
Everyone telling me to purchase Pride and Prejudice after I said that it was in streaming. And I'm like, do I want to make that investment? Should I? I wish there was like a 2-for-1 deal with Pride and Prejudice and Emma. I would definitely buy that.
Well, Emma is leaving HBO, so you should.
You didn't have to upset her like that.
I'm sorry. So I'm glad that you were introduced to films that you had never seen before that I personally love. So I think this is a win-win situation for everyone. Because I think you all like them.
We'll leave you in suspense.
I'm in my mind, you like them. So that makes me happy.
That's all for today's episode. We'd like to thank you for listening and to give a shout out to all the kind people sending love our way. If you'd like to keep up with us, make sure to follow us at Film Posers on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. Where can they find you, posers?
So you can find me on Twitter at Gabby_Burgos27 and on Letterboxd at Gabby Cristina.
And you can find me on Instagram and on Twitter as Anna_Sophia53 and on Letterboxd as Anna_Sophia.
And you can find me on Twitter and on Letterboxd at Leading Mohicans.
And finally, you can find me at The Josie Marie on Twitter and Letterboxd. Again, thank you for listening. And remember, we're all film posers. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Remember, Spinbreakers is a period film.
Yes, sir.
Oh my God.
No.